Hi, and welcome to the sixth edition of the Medical Radio Podcast Show with Sue and Larry Robbins. We have a number of interesting topics today, and the first one is an interesting article that just came out on Actonel preventing fractures better than Fosamax. And I wanted to talk a bit about why we use Actonel, Fosamax, and the other one is Boniva. These are marvelous medicines for those with osteoporosis or pre-osteoporosis, which sometimes they call osteopenia, and they help to prevent bone loss and actually improve bone resorption and get more bones and more calcium. Now, before we talk about some of the pluses and minuses of this group of drugs, Susie, I know that you take the Actonel for the pre-osteoporosis. What do you think?
Well, I thought it was actually very encouraging to hear that Actonel is working well. You know, I certainly, for all those people out there who also take Fosamax, I, you know, hope they both work well for people with osteopenia or osteoporosis.
Has it been difficult to take? Do you have side effects?
For me, not at all. I've had no side effects. I am looking forward to having my second bone density test to see if being on the Actonel has really made a difference for me.
Now, recently, there was some negative publicity about this group of drugs, and it had to do with necrosis or a severe degeneration of the jaw, osteonecrosis it's called, due to the Fosamax, Actonel, Boniva type of drugs. And it's a very rare side effect. People are predisposed to that side effect who have dental problems where they have cavities that haven't been filled. They have gum problems. They have infections in the gum. And older patients are more predisposed. But that osteonecrosis or jaw problem from these drugs has actually been pretty rare, while osteoporosis is very common. And unfortunately, in my practice, what I've seen is a number of people who say they don't want to take these drugs because they've heard that it causes a jaw problem. And I don't know the percentage of jaw problems. It's very, very low. There's not been very many reported cases to the FDA. But the upshot of osteoporosis is terrible, with fractures, with a greatly decreased quality of life. So probably to not take the drugs because of the jaw problem is not a great idea. But this is not the first example where publicity has been fueled in the media about a drug or side effects. A lot of people don't take it, and then the consequences are more than that side effect. For instance, antidepressants and suicide. The antidepressants lower suicide. That's been shown. And since the whole flap about antidepressants and suicide risk, there's been a number of studies that indicate that antidepressants overall lower suicide risk. But what we saw was some people go off antidepressants because of the negative publicity, and then their suicide risk actually goes up, besides their quality of life. Now, these drugs are usually once a week. Fosamax has a once a week. Actonel has a once a week. Boniva is once a month. How about, now, Susie, how about the stomach problems with esophageal reflux? Or, because I know you had had some problem with that. How about that with these drugs?
Well, you know, when I first heard that, when I first talked to my doctor who recommended that I get on one of these bone strengthening drugs, she had warned me that I had to sit up for at least half an hour after taking the drug in the morning. And we talked about why, and because I do have a history of having reflux, there was some concern in being able to tolerate it. But it's been just fine. There have been no problems. And, you know, I wanted to just mention your discussion a moment ago of the pros and cons of taking one of these drugs with the concern of getting the jaw problems is, I think for any of us who have seen osteoporosis in our families, it's a fairly easy decision to say, I'm going to go with the drug because I do not want to get osteoporosis.
Very, very well said. And I think that we'll segue on to another interesting study that just came out yesterday. These are all cutting-edge studies that we're talking about today. And it's about Paxil, or the generic is paroxetine. It's an antidepressant with pregnancy. And the upshot is that we probably should not use Paxil with pregnancy because of the increased risk of birth defects. And the issue, though, is depression and pregnancy. Should women be treated? How should they be treated? And what are the risks to the fetus and to the mom? Now, depression, with or without pregnancy, is a serious illness that affects millions and millions of people. About 17% of people lifetime get into major depression or mild or moderate chronic depression. So it's almost a fifth of people. And during pregnancy, we were always taught, and I think there is evidence to show that depression in the mom can increase the risk of birth defects and problems with a baby. And certainly postpartum depression with lack of attachment and problems with the baby in various ways. And then as an adult, depression rears its ugly head. So depression is not very benign for the mom, certainly. There's a risk of suicide, but decreased quality of life, loss of relationships and jobs. But depression also can affect that developing fetus, forgetting about the medicine. So then, how do we treat depression with pregnancy? Now, outside of medicine, since we do want to minimize medicine with pregnancy, Susie, what about outside of medicine? How about therapy? What kind of therapist should people search for? And what actually happens in therapy?
That's a good point, because you know, there are obviously now many people who are depressed during pregnancy and are looking to seek relief. And as you just mentioned, the rate of babies being healthier with their mothers being healthy emotionally is only good for both of them. I would say a few things that would be very important for a pregnant woman is, number one, support. Whether it be family and friends, people around her, maybe getting into some groups, a group with other pregnant women who are going through the same stages that this individual is, maybe joining some sort of clubs. Obviously, getting in with a therapist, as we've talked about on this program many times, is good for anybody, especially somebody who is depressed and maybe at that point cannot take medicine.
How about social worker, therapist versus PhD psychologist?
Well, you know, I think the right connection between the therapist and the individual is what is most important. I would say, though, that at this point in a woman's life, that most likely for to deal with her depression while she's pregnant, especially if she's never been in therapy before, I would say seeing a therapist who can help her with the here and now, how she's feeling, how she's dealing with her life, rather than going back in more of a psychoanalytic type of therapy, talking about her childhood, et cetera. So I think for the moment, being pregnant, getting through that pregnancy in as healthy of a manner as she can, I think somebody who could support her and help her with behavioral techniques would be most helpful.
So more day-to-day client-centered therapy and not analytic type.
Absolutely.
As much. Now, with medicines, it's risk-benefit ratio. If somebody is severely depressed, there are risks to the SSRIs, the antidepressants that are most commonly used, Prozac, Paxil, Celexa, Lexapro, Zoloft. Several of those have generics now. Effexor and Cymbalta also. But if somebody's severely depressed, there's the risk of suicide. There's the risk, I think, of depression on the baby, because depression does affect a lot of your neurochemicals and other chemicals in the bloodstream, and that may affect the fetus. So if we choose medicine, of course, we try to avoid it the first trimester if we can. We try to stop it before the last month of before delivery to avoid complications and minimize dose, minimize the medication. But many women do need antidepressants with pregnancy, and they have to have a good discussion with the OB-GYN and with the doctor that's treating them with the drug as far as risks and benefits, do we know all the risks? There have been a fair amount of studies on antidepressants with pregnancy, and there are small risks associated, but it's not as if 50% of babies born to moms who take antidepressants during pregnancy are going to have birth defects. The normal birth defect rate is 3 or 4% in that range, and with certain antidepressants, it might be very slightly higher. With some antidepressants, it might not be really much higher at all. And it's really an individual decision, but we don't want to withhold medicine if a woman really needs it. As far as postpartum depression, interestingly enough, there was recently an article that in men, postpartum depression is just as common as in women. And so some of it's hormones, of course, with women, but it may be lack of sleep, financial stress on men, change in the marriage and the relationship, all kinds of things that lead to postpartum depression in men. Susie, any thoughts on postpartum depression in men and women?
Well, as you were mentioning that, I was thinking to myself, what about, there must be many, many women who fall into this category who have never been depressed and sailed right through pregnancy, but once the baby was born and they're home with the baby, the depression sets in. And I'm not exclusively saying postpartum depression of, you know, the psychotic, very strong type, but how about just your average depression where the new mom is able to get up and function and take care of the baby, but just feels really crummy inside?
Well, I think that we do need treatment. People have to see a therapist and or a psychiatrist. There's three scenarios postpartum. There's regular mild to moderate depression, or sometimes mild, that tends to be self-limiting. There's moderate or severe depression, and we always think bipolar. The experts in bipolar feel that maybe 4% of the whole population fits the bipolar spectrum, BSD, bipolar spectrum disorder. And there's two really good sources for bipolar. One is DBSA, Depression Bipolar Support Alliance, which has a good website, and also bphope.com, which also has a magazine on bipolar. But a lot of regular depression out there is misdiagnosed as actually bipolar. And then, as you alluded to, the severe psychotic depression that is rare, but when it happens, there's a threat for suicide or for homicide, killing the child or kids, which tragically happens because the woman really is not in reality and ends up going to jail, but could be, if we could just treat it, could be fine and get through that period. But the regular postpartum depression that I think it's multifactorial. There's a genetic tendency towards depression. There's lack of sleep. There's finances. There's lack of change in relationship. I'm interested in relational issues postpartum because for men, anyways, there's finances. There's the mom's attention is turned not towards me, the man, but towards the baby naturally. So we become more co-parents and not so much married to each other. And we might think, what could we do? What could people do to prevent this as far as a relationship? What do you think, Susie?
Well, I think what you're saying is absolutely true, and any of us who've been parents can think back to what it was like when we had a newborn and maybe a toddler or two running around that. As wonderful as the time can be, it's also very stressful and tiring. When I think back to my own days as a young mother, and thinking about going back to work much too soon, although I needed to at that time, it sure would be nice if parents could get some relief, say, for a couple hours at night, where maybe they could go out to dinner and somebody could come in and stay with the baby and or older brother or sister. Any way that the parents can connect with themselves in a way that hasn't anything to do with the children. I think that is, as you were saying, parents become co-parents with each other. They lose sight of themselves as a couple, and more just everything revolves around the kids.
Now, this segues into another recent article titled Marital Woes Can Hinder Good Parenting, which seems obvious and self-evident. Sometimes we see marital problems come out in kids with headaches. I happen to see a lot of headaches, and in adolescents with severe headaches, we always look at marital problems. But this was a large study, and to quote, overall, the researchers found mothers who were in a hostile or emotionally withdrawn relationship were less likely than other mothers to have warm, loving interactions with their children. The same was true of fathers who were in an emotionally withdrawn marriage. The kids, of course, have trouble adjusting at school and with schoolwork, and they act out. The interesting thing I always think is chicken and the egg, genetic versus environment with studies like this, because say you have two parents who are emotionally withdrawn and angry, and then the kids are anxious and acting out. Well, it's obviously, the relationship between the parents isn't good. That affects the kids. But also, the parents may have maybe bipolar or have a personality disorder or anxiety. And so the kids may genetically also. So we may see that anyways in the kids, even if the parents weren't that way. Susie, what do you think?
Well, I agree with what you're saying. And I, as you were mentioning it, I was thinking conversely, what about in a family situation where there's a mother and father who are somewhat emotionally estranged from each other, and one of their children bears the brunt of that and may grow up to be depressed and or anxious, and then you have another child within the family who has been parented by the same parents and grows up and seems to have been able to get through childhood without bearing the brunt of the parents' dysfunction. You know, we've brought up this word resilience before. Is this an organic situation where this kid just happens to have better brain chemistry and can it gives him or her the strength to get through the dysfunction?
It's very fascinating, the whole concept of resilience, which you can look at resilience in couples, in companies, but in individuals and kids, there definitely is the organic part. And there was a wonderful article on this not too long ago. We've talked about that on this program. There's the serotonin transporter gene, which is a physical gene. And looking at it, you can predict how resilient people are in general if they'll become severely depressed. For instance, if kids have a horrible upbringing with abuse, etc., about 17% of those kids will turn out great no matter what. They're very resilient, and it turns out they have usually two long arms to their serotonin transporter gene. And then a lot of the kids brought up with abuse, etc., will be okay, and they have a long and a short arm. So you can almost predict. But I think that when we talk about resilience, it's interesting looking at how people parent one kid versus another. Say you have two kids, and this has been done in videotape ways where they'll videotape moms interacting with their 10 and their 12-year-old, and they show how the mom interacts with the older versus the younger, whether she's hugging them, touching them, how much attention, and sometimes you can almost predict how those kids are going to be. But that brings up another chicken in the head with these videotaped studies. For instance, there's been videotape studies with kids who have ADD, and they're trying to show that people may treat kids with ADD differently and produce the ADD. But actually what was discovered was that the kid's behavior will affect how the parents, of course, treat them. For instance, kids with ADHD who are very active, a little six-year-old boy who's constantly moving around, when he actually sits, everybody ignores him because they want to leave him alone. So you can't always tell, it's the chicken and the egg, what's causing what with these interesting videotape studies. But resilience is very interesting. Why does one kid from a bad environment end up terrific and one end up not so terrific or as a total mess? And I think a lot of it actually is genetic. But let me ask, Susie, how about birth order?
I think birth order is just another piece of the pie that can affect a child's introduction to the world and how people see him or her and relate to him. You know, let's look at firstborns, for example. Maybe I'm bringing this up because I myself was a firstborn. But I think where you are in your family probably does have some bearing on the personality that's formed within you as you grow up. I know for myself, being the firstborn and also being a girl, in my family it was girl, girl, boy, boy, boy. It was almost two separate families. We had the three younger boys and the two older sisters. And as being the oldest sister and also the oldest in the family, there were duties that fell to me, such as babysitting, cleaning up after my brothers, helping out with my brothers, kind of being mom's little helper. So I think it can make a difference. But of course, I am speaking from personal experience.
It's interesting. You know, traditionally we were taught that the firstborn gets all of the neuroticism and anxiety of the mom and the dad because the parents don't have any experience and they are overly indulgent. And I always laugh with first-time moms. I ask them, and the kid is, say, 3 months old, have you been teaching them the Latin and French flashcards yet? And then recently I had a mom in who has four children, and her youngest is five, and she looks at me and laughs and says, I don't even know if my youngest reads yet or not. So that's the difference between a mom with one child and one with four children. But there's a lot of exceptions. There's a lot of firstborns who are very normal psychologically, don't have the anxiety and the intensity, and a lot of second and third borns who do. So I think that there's so many exceptions to this. Susie, what do you think?
I think that probably genetics in the end certainly can play maybe even a bigger part than birth order.
Now, on another topic, there's this class of medicines that I've talked about on the show before, antipsychotics, the atypical antipsychotics. And I think it's a terrible name because most of the people who take them in this country are not, it's not for psychosis. It's for mild bipolar. And what we really need, I spoke recently at the Depression Bipolar Support Alliance patient meeting where we had 450 patients. And what I said, what we really need is a mild bipolar book, sort of bipolar light, the mild end of the bipolar spectrum. I think somebody should write that because most patients fit into that. And a lot of patients with mild or more severe or with more severe problems do take these atypical antipsychotics such as Seroquel, Zyprexa, Risperdal, and then Geodon and Abilify. But the problem is diabetes and weight gain leading to diabetes, maybe insulin resistance leading to diabetes having not that much to do with weight gain. And it's been implicated as a class, although Zyprexa is the worst in this class and the others aren't as bad, and actually Geodon and Abilify don't seem very bad at all. But these are such remarkably useful medicines. They're being used in kids. And there's recently a study adding in a diabetes medicine, a mild diabetes medicine called metformin, into this, minimizes the weight gain and the diabetes issue. And this study was actually done in 10 to 18-year-olds who were taking these medicines, and the metformin resulted in weight loss, which is huge because that's the big problem with these medicines, is weight gain. The conclusion in the study was that metformin decreased the children's risk of diabetes by lowering insulin resistance and having favorable effects on glucose or sugar metabolism. It's well tolerated. Metformin is actually a very well tolerated drug with very few adverse events. So the way I see it, any way that we can use these drugs, the atypicals, such as Zyprexa, Seroquel, Risperdal particularly, the big side effect being weight gain, if we can minimize that, it's terrific because these medicines do change the quality of life for quite a number of people. Susie, what do you think?
Well, it sounds like a breakthrough. Any time that children need to be on medicine and they're going off of it because of the weight gain, you know, it's twofold. It's too bad that they're gaining this weight, and it's also bad that they're not taking the medicine they need. What about for adults? Can this diabetic drug also be used for adults?
I'm sure it can, and metformin is actually mostly used in adults. There's many adults on these medicines, Zyprexa, Seroquel, etc. And I think after this study, we'll see more and more people on the medicines also given the diabetes medicine metformin. Now, on another topic, there was an article that came out of London recently on psychopaths showing that their brains are really different than normal people, non-psychopaths, and that it's really a biological problem. And I've thought about this quite a bit. We've talked about personality disorders on this program before. If you talk about severe antisocial personality disorder, such as Scott Peterson, who was convicted of killing his wife, Lacey, I think that there are a lot of things wrong with our brains. They sort of look normal, these people. They can be charming. But if you look at OJ, if you look at Scott Peterson, I would make the case that these people are just as sick psychiatrically as somebody who is severely schizophrenic. I don't think that they should be let off of their crimes because they do know right from wrong. Scott Peterson went to pretty good lengths to try to cover up his crime. But I think that they do have a very sick brain. It's not as if they can turn around and really be normal. Susie, what do you think about psychopaths and Scott Petersons of the world?
You know, I've read, probably like a lot of our listeners out there, a lot on the Scott Peterson case, and I've read a few of the books. And one thing that struck me with his situation is how he methodically planned this murder, methodically worked to keep the police off of his tail, and at the end of it, had no remorse about killing his wife. So is that a second piece of it? The one, the planning and wanting to kill the wife, and then secondly, having no guilt about it.
Isn't that incredible? The absolute flatness of their response in court, when they're faced with the death, it's almost unbelievable. They're missing that piece of their brain. Now, what do you think their motivation is when they kill their loved one or kill their wife or kill their husband or poison them? Why do you think a lot of these people do it?
Well, do you think that they just want an easier life? You know, as life gets tougher with bills, children, etc., that they just want to bail out of it? They just want to keep things simple?
I think so. I think that they see that's an easier way. And the only remorse that they do show later, they feel sorry for themselves because they've lost the relationship or they're in jail for the rest of their lives. And they are sorry about that. They're not really sorry that somebody they know has died. They're sorry really that they've lost not only that relationship, but all their relationships.
And with Scott Peterson, I've always wondered, if he knew what was going to happen in the end, that he'd be sent to San Quentin for the rest of his life, would he have just not done it? Would he have just lived his life with Lacey and just went along? Or is he glad in some way that he did kill her?
Well, it's interesting. I think that if he knew he was going to end up in San Quentin and caught, he would not have killed her. But we tend in our country, in the media, to build up these people thinking that they're Hannibal Lecter and they have an IQ of 170. But most of the average folks who are antisocial personality disorders or sociopaths aren't that smart. Scott Peterson wasn't that smart. He did a lot of dumb things. And in retrospect, at least in a book that I read, obviously, he could have done other things, but they also, not only is their intelligence or lack of, or their average minus intelligence, they're not Anthony Hopkins and Hannibal Lecter, but they also have in the back of their mind that the rules don't apply to them. That's part of that personality disorder. The rules don't apply to them. They have a sense of entitlement, and they think that they're really never going to be caught. They can just say this. They can, Scott Peterson, for I'm using him as an example, just figured that he could just tell people that she's missing and he went fishing, and they'll ask him maybe a question, and that's about it. Susie?
Well, it makes me wonder that people, say like a Scott Peterson, who obviously have defects in their personality, and if they were born with it, that's lousy. It's too bad that he has those crummy traits. But on the other hand, does that mean he's not guilty of what he's done?
Well, I think it is biological. I do feel a little bit bad for Scott Peterson's of the world, although if he did that to somebody that I loved, or, you know, I don't feel real bad. There's a lot of other people I feel a lot worse for. But I think that legally, when we look at right and wrong, there's people who are obviously criminally insane. For instance, they cut off their mom's head and put it on a stake and put it out on their front porch and are hallucinating that they're the devil, etc. But then the Scott Petersons of the world are different because they obviously knew a right or wrong because they're trying to cover it up. Well, I think we'll wrap it up here. Next week we'll have another edition, radio show number 7, with lots more topics. And if you want to suggest any topics, please give me an email. Our email is right on headachedrugs.com, right on the website there. Thanks for listening.